Yeah, it is.
Okay. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk and the returning Phil Brynan. Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello. So this week's session was Mastering Third-Party Relationships Part 2. Previously, we'd spoken about the post office scandal. We touched on due diligence and the level of granularity you go into and how to differentiate between joint controllers and independent controller relationships. So we kind of picked up where we left off this week, aside from the news, and we had a little quiz, dare I say it. It went okay. And it was just a few scenario-based questions on what the relationship is between two parties. So we uncovered that a little bit to discuss that and then delved into international transfers and, well, our threat to adequacy potentially, as well as just, you know, the issues that you generally face day to day with international transfers from, you know, an organizational perspective. And we touched a little bit on a case that you've been, both been working on this week, didn't we? Around third parties as well, conveniently. How did you find it?
Yeah, I thought it was a good session. I think you two did a brilliant job. I was a bit more of a passenger this week. My brain not quite firing on all cylinders this afternoon.
We didn't notice.
But yeah, I thought it was a really good session. I quite like the part when, you know, we obviously focus quite heavily on relationships between organizations and where, you know, whether it's controller to controller or joint controllers or controller to processor. And I Phil threw a bit of a spanner in the works, didn't he, halfway through by bringing up the idea of thinking about third party relationships with organizations and people or and other organizations such as, you know, the ICO, for example, or advisors such as ourselves. And that's not something really you consider, is it? But I thought it was a good thing to kind of just to throw in the middle of the session and just to get the cogs turning, really.
Yeah, well, definitely got the cogs turning. I don't know if any output came from me.
I don't think so. I think we've got a lot of groan, like and groans. But I was just wondering if we're billing this as mastering third party relationships. I was thinking, well, what other relationships other than processors and controllers do we have with people in this space, you know, like, as I say, the ICO and advisors and ad hoc requests for data, you know, from controllers rather than kind of structured sharing stuff. Anyway, it was just all
there. It's a good point, though, Phil, because you don't often think about it, do you? Like you say, it's you just kind of focus on the controller to processor relationships or joint controllers or controller to controller. So it's definitely worth bringing up for sure.
Yeah, I think on that point as well, while, you know, not all relationships might be between controllers and processors, to make sure that you alleviate any risk that personal data will be shared with those third parties that don't fall into them categories, even though, you know, it is still possible and likely that that will happen. For example, with the ICO, if you're reporting a breach, you know, an organization might include personal details, even though they try and steer away from that, it might still happen. So, yeah, a lot of food for thought. Clearly.
I thought that was your stepping off point there.
Yeah, I know. It did seem that way.
Missed it.
Fair. I suppose I'll take that route. And yeah, we hope you enjoyed the session. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back next week with a GDPR radio. View on what news you've seen, but I want to pick this one up myself. Has anyone seen the news on Neuralink?
Yes.
Elon Musk's Neuralink.
Yes, I saw that last night, I think.
It's gobsmacking. So basically, they have been testing on humans, or they've received, approval to start testing on humans. And the first person that they've tested on, let me just take it back for those of you who don't know Neuralink. So this is a chip that gets implanted into your brain to fix issues. Thank you, Joe. To fix issues like paralysis or maybe even dementia. Like, honestly, it's really broad ranging, the potential it's got. But their first aim, Neuralink's first aim, was to have someone move a computer mouse with using their thoughts, and they've been successful, which is just mental and a little bit scary. But Sean says she's seen that film and it didn't end well. Yeah, I know, it's the beginning, isn't it?
Yeah, and I saw that in the news. That I think it was last night, was it, or the night before? I thought, wow.
I know. I really wanted to see Joe's reaction when he first heard the news, because I know you're not the biggest fan.
I'm not the biggest fan of AI, no. And you told me earlier, so no one gets to see it, unfortunately. But while we're on the kind of topic of, would you class it as AI? Is it AI?
What?
Neuralink.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. Well, while we're on the topic of advanced technology, did you see that ChatGPT starting to be aggressive to people the other day? I saw it on Twitter.
You've got to be polite to it. I am very, very polite to ChatGPT always.
I don't think that allows justification for, if you weren't being polite to it, I don't think that allows justification for ChatGPT to.
Well, maybe it had a bad day. Maybe it got out of bed the wrong side. What is virtual bed the wrong side? Now, I don't know if you saw this. Go on, carry on.
No, I was just going to say, people were just making jokes about it turning into, I can't remember the name of it. Do you know Avengers? What's the name of the bloody movie? Escapes me, should know. I don't know. Besides the point. Go on, Phil, carry on.
Ultron.
No, I was going Ultron, to say, there's a couple of things I saw in the news, right? One, which is quite bizarre to me, is Sainsbury's is using AI. It's got a trial in St. Albans, and it's locking booze behind these glass doors, and it's called the Freedom Case, ironically. So they're locking away the booze and calling it the Freedom Case. And they've got to basically use a touch screen to get the doors open, to get the booze out. Now, they're saying at the moment they're not using Nectar cards and, AI to determine whether people are over 18. It's just a glorified like ring doorbell. You push it and the security team have a look at you and then monitor you taking booze out of the cabinet. But the AI is doing things like checking if what you've got in your hand. There's quite a good video. It's saying this hand's empty, that hand's not empty. And then, of course, it's just one step away from face recognition. But I mean, it just strikes, why bother? I mean,
it seems like
I'm just not going to even bother to buy booze from Sainsbury's if it's like that.
But why bother even put that in place in the first place rather than just being a person that asks for your ID? Like, if you're going to implement something like this, you know, you're going to need to undertake a DPIA, and it's going to ask you the question, you know, is there alternate methods of achieving the purpose of processing than what you want to do? And IDing someone in another method is easily done by another person. You know,
they're trying to save on costs, aren't they?
Yeah, but are they going to
save on costs? I don't know how it passed that question, though.
Yeah, they're going to cut down on shoplifting, aren't they? But I mean, I noticed I was in Lidl in North Allerton the other day, and they've taken all the self-checkouts out. It's this big wave to put them in, and now it's a big wave to take them all out again.
Yeah, they did that in the Morrisons near me as well. They had loads of big ones, but then they put loads in, and then they've gone back out and put more normal self-checkouts in.
Yeah. So I also saw, which I put a link in the chat here, for your fingerprints can be recreated from the sounds made when you swipe on a touch screen was the headline. And there's some researchers in China and America, and they've got this app called Print Listener, and it listens to you moving around on your touch screen, and it can recreate with 27.9% accuracy your fingerprints somehow from the sound of you moving around on your touch screen. So that was really, I put it in the link there so that people can read it thinking what, but it's kind of a relatively short article, but it's like, wow, that's quite surprising, really.
I feel like we've got no chance against personal security with these things are already in development and already, you know, being tried. It's scary, the scale of, you know, where these things can go. I've never thought that was possible. Yeah, it's a bit ridiculous. Maybe we just need to tone it down a little bit.
Yeah. Now, I also saw in the news only this morning, actually, on Freebasy, that an MEP, Paul Tang, has raised concerns in the European Commission about the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill and its impact on the EU's General Protection Regulation in the UK and adequacy. So, again, that's quite interesting. And I was reading some stuff about the Nigerian Data Protection Act, and it's absolutely, I think I might have put it in some notes, it's absolutely amazing, some of the stuff really that they've built in, which I think is far takes it far beyond where the GDPR is. So there's an annual audit you've got to do if you're posting over a certain number. It's a relatively low threshold, like 2,000 data subjects. Then you have to do, you have to, one, register. Two, you have to have an approved contractor, you know, who's approved by their equivalent of the ICO, to do any advisory work. And you've got to submit an annual return, and you've got to do an audit every year. Well, wow, that's really, you know, I think that's really good, you know, stringent stuff. So you're just thinking that what, you know, we're saying, oh, is the Nigerian environment adequate, you know, so on and so forth. You know, I'd have thought sooner that be saying the other way around, you know, is the UK and is the EU an adequate arrangement if there's none of this kind of control in place? It's all a little bit woolly with these ropers.
Is that similar to the Jamaican Data Protection Act? I know you've done some research into that as well.
Yeah, it's similar in some respects. In the Jamaican Data Protection Act, a data protection impact assessment is an annual return you've got to submit to the ICO. There's no requirement to have an annual audit, and there's no kind of regulation of consultants providing advice. But you have to report non-compliances as well as personal data breaches in the Jamaican Act. So the data protection officer or senior responsible person, you know, has got an obligation to legal obligation to report them, you know, having given the data controller a sensible, reasonable period of time to correct it. So, you know, again, there's some really good things I'm seeing. I'm never sure everybody else is seeing in other overseas data protection legislation. And all we're doing is we're going the opposite way. We're watering it down.
Yeah, but it's all about saving organisations money, Phil, and not actually protecting people's rights and freedoms. We don't care about data subjects. It's all about how we can line our pockets with as much cash as possible.
Short term, if you lose adequacy.
They're not weighing that up, are they? They're looking at the short term. Right, how can we cut down all these costs, save money, but then in theory put the bill at risk and our adequacy decision at jeopardy, which then will incur more costs. Although, actually, funny enough, did you see there was a report in the news that the GDPR supposedly increases data storage and computation costs and reduces data volume, according to a research by US-based National Bureau of Economic Research Regulation. Regulation changes are demanding for data. The NBER estimates that the EU's GDPR has led the 20 million companies operating in the EU to both store and process less data, resulting in cost of GDPR compliance from a cloud computing perspective, ranging from $1.7 million for SMEs to $70 million for large enterprises.
Right. OK, there's lots of stuff going on. I don't know if you saw in the news also, somebody at Stratford-on-Avon District Council was caught and I don't think prosecuted for stealing 79,000 email addresses from the waste collection database in order to help build and promote their own business that they just started. Now, they got arrested, but they were apparently very, very sorry for their actions and apologised sincerely to the police, and they just got an official caution, a slap on the wrist. But I mean, there must be loads of people that do that, you know, leave their employer and nick the database. Steph's put in something about New Zealanders saying they deserve to shop for their milk and bread without having their faces scanned. Just milk and bread? What about if you're buying juice? Is that a different matter? Or booze might be a different matter? Only joking. I saw something interesting, which might be quite useful. I'll put it in the chat. PC World sent out, published something about how to keep your home network secure. You know, there's like some tips and tricks. I'm just wondering whether that's the sort of thing that might be worth sending out to employees, or find it and put it into the chat, send off to our colleagues, particularly where we've got home working. You know, I'm wondering what we do to make sure that they've got a secure connection, secure environment.
Sorry, I was concentrating on the chat there, Phil.
Yeah, me too.
Right. Okay. Apologies. And did you see that the French have had a humongous data breach? 33 million people's data has been, so that's half the French population's data has been stolen. So remember when HMRC lost 25 million households database in the UK? Mm. That was a fairly large data breach, but that was just CDs that went missing in the post and never turned up. Well, two French healthcare payment service providers have had phishing attacks, and basically there's a lot of personal data of 33 million people as being stolen, according to the CNIL. So they said no banking information, no medical data or contact information was affected. It was mostly just dates of birth, marital status, social security numbers, insurance information, names, addresses, family composition, that type of thing. But that was that. Did you see that in the news? That was quite interesting.
No, I didn't. I did see though that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has fined Avast. Have you seen that? $16.5 million selling consumer data.
Oh right, so, really? What were they in violation of?
Because they, I think they sell their services on the fact that customer data is protected, and they're selling it without consent. It's quite a messy one, to be fair. So, FTC has alleged that Avast has sold data to more than 100 third parties through its subsidiary, its Czechoslovakian subsidiary JumpShot. So it includes browsing data such as user web searches, web pages they visited, revealing customers' religious beliefs, health concerns, political leanings, location, financial status, visits to child-directed content, and other sensitive information.
I wonder how Avast is getting that kind of information, though. Political leanings.
Yeah. It says here the company claimed that it used a special algorithm to remove identifying information before transferring the data to its clients. That doesn't answer your question, but however, the FTC says the company failed to sufficiently anonymize consumers' data. Consumers' browsing information that it sold in non-aggregate form through various products. For example, its data feeds include a unique identifier for each web browser it collected information from, and could include every website visited, precise timestamps, type of device, and browser data.
Crikey,
heck. Yeah, it goes on.
So I just wondered when I said what the basis was. I wonder what American law was violated. That's what I'm wondering, whether it was.
This article didn't really specify, to be fair, but they've been, as well as the fine, they've been ordered to, they've been prohibited from selling or licensing any browsing data from Avast branded products to third parties for advertising purposes, obtain affirmative express consent from consumers for selling or licensing browsing data from non-Avast products to third parties for these purposes. Notifying consumers about the fact that the data was sold, and implementing a privacy program as well. Somebody's got their hand up here. I can't see who, but feel free to unmute.
Yes, David.
Hiya.
Just for a change.
Hello.
Fairly sure it's CCPA. The US are pretty strong on the resale of data and opting in or allowing people to opt out of the resale of data. I don't know whether you said, Jasmine, but the company in question is actually English. I know the subsidiary is Czech, but it's an English company.
Yeah.
But I think that was one that was interesting. And then there was a French CNIL finding that I think has got quite a lot wider relevance. Amazon France were fined quite heavily. The first two areas were around the detailed level of tracking, which I don't think is going to be applicable to most people. It's the fact that they had to click their scanners every 30 seconds to provide a trace of where they were, and I think we all realize that's probably a little challenging. I think the third was caused me enough concern that we're reviewing our policies. So they made a statement about how contractors were delivered privacy notices, and essentially that an online sort of an intranet delivered privacy notice was not applicable for contractors who wouldn't have access to the intranet, which is actually sounds really bad, but actually I don't think is that far off for a lot of manufacturing businesses, where not all of your core people will have access to that way of delivering data. So we're actually reviewing not how we deliver it for a first time, but how we keep people on top of privacy notices. But I thought that was really relevant for a lot of businesses, where the other two were probably very Amazon specific.
That's a very, very good point. Thanks for bringing that up. We did talk about the Amazon one a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, with the Amazon fine. You raised it, Joe, didn't you? I remember now in the session. And I did see something about a CCPA violation this morning, but I didn't read it. It was in Lexology, and that might well have been the Avast one, but I thought, I'm not going to read that. It's US. I haven't got time today to read it, but it might well. I'll have to go back and have a read of it.
Well, That's 20 minutes down already. I mean, I've got two more quick ones.
The rulings from the European Court of Justice have ruled that police may not store biometric data of criminals indefinitely. So they're saying you can't store it until the person that's with a criminal record dies. You've got to have a much shorter period. And the background to this is in Bulgaria, this guy had done something. He got a 1-year suspended sentence. Basically he applied to get this data erased after a period of time and was told no, it's going to stay there forever. So he's challenged it, and he's won, which is interesting. Another one, I'm going to give you a question, right? So you collect customer data for the purpose of performing a subscriber agreement, right? You're an online platform. Would it be lawful to then use that for testing in a test database, for testing, subscriber stuff in a test database? So you've collected it with the purposes of performing subscriber agreements and that type of stuff. You then want to use it for testing purposes in a test database.
It's a tricky one, but it depends how you angle it, really, because if it's to improve the service that you're providing to that customer, then potentially, or subscriber.
Spot on. You haven't seen this note, so well done. Yeah, spot on. That's exactly what the ruling was, that the basic challenge was challenged on the purpose limitation and storage limitation, and they said that the purpose of using the customer data for testing subscriber error trapping and stuff like that was entirely consistent with and connected to the purpose it originally was acquired for, which is interesting. But the problem was that the data had been left in this test database for a year and a half, and so they got fined for leaving it and not complying with the storage limitation principle.
Fiona's asked in the chat was by what biometric data was involved, and was the ruling for all of it or some parts of it?
That's a good question. Just bear with me. Carry on talking.
If I say something, it'll completely change conversations.
Yeah, we're waiting on you, really.
I'll have to check because I'll put the link in. I'll have to check. I'm not sure. I'm assuming it was fingerprints, but I don't know, and haven't got it in my notes. So apologies.
Yeah, I find, that first the first point you made, I find that interesting, because I was reading about the AI Act and how there's, if it's approved, how there's an exception from the GDPR for AI biases. So to prevent, biased processing of data under artificial intelligence. So it's for high risk AI platforms that will have this AIs that will have this this exception that can, they can apply it. And the article was basically saying, I think it was the IAPP, that there's no lawful basis under the GDPR, under Article 9, for collecting using biometric data for preventing AI biases. So to use it, to test the AI and make sure that it doesn't make biased decisions on people. And I just thought, what about substantial public interest?
Yeah, that came because, to my mind. Safeguarding individuals at risk, perhaps.
Well, the thing with that is that's under the UK Data Protection Act, whereas this is the EU GDPR. Okay. So obviously that doesn't apply to them. But even still, how far does substantial public interest go if you can't apply it for that? That seems very, much in the interest of everyone, really. So yeah. I don't know. I'd probably need to look further into that and why they didn't consider it and why this is going to be an exception in a new piece of legislation. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting. Anyway, let's go on to the reason why everybody is here. So it is Mastering Third Party Relationships Part 2. So last time we briefly spoke, well, we didn't briefly speak, well, we covered a lot on the post office scandal. I think we went down a rabbit hole with that. And then maybe more briefly spoke about due diligence and the granularity of due diligence, controllership relationships, and how you skew the lines between joint and independent controllers. And with that, I want to pick up that conversation again, because it is very difficult when I think it's one of those that you can think yourself into a rabbit hole with control the relationships and, you know, what actually is happening, because you can argue a mutual interest or intention in a process and activity to some scale for most. So at what point is it a joint controller relationship where they're jointly determining the means and purposes, and at what point is it, you know, independent? But I thought, anyway, when you're engaging with a third party, you need to first establish what that relationship will be, whether it's controllership or controller to processor, even sub-processors if they're involved, potentially. So we thought we'd put together a little scenario quiz. Now, please don't go running after our track record, but I'm going to put a few scenarios out there, and you tell me whether you think it will, what the relationship is really. So everyone get involved, maybe Joe and Phil, I know you'll be eager, but just let a couple of people answer before you jump in.
I'm not ready yet, so I'll be holding back.
We'll start off with an easy one. So scenario one, we've got a clothing company that collects customer data through its online store. The company uses a cloud service provider to store the data, and the cloud service provider has access to the data for operational purposes, but does not process it for any other reason. What is this relationship? So have a think and put in the chat what you think this will be. And hopefully it is an easy start for you as well. So David has put controller to processor. And just David so far. We've got another one coming in now from Keely. I think most people are of the same opinion. So yeah, it's correct. This is a controller to processor relationship. So the clothing company is the controller and the cloud service provider is the processor. Number two, a political party contracts a research company to carry out research for voter modelling purposes. The political party specifies its budget and that it wants to understand the characteristics of voters in particular geographical areas that are likely to vote for them. The party leaves it to the research company to determine sample sizes, survey methods, and presentation of results. What is this relationship? And be specific. That's not a hint. So Vicky's put joint controllership. What are your thoughts, Joe and Phil?
I agree. I wasn't listening.
I do agree, joint controllership, because they're both. And,
yeah, I thought so.
If you want to go, yes. Well,
yeah, for what reason?
They're both determining the means and purposes. So although the political party, you know, are the ones that are driving the research, they're leaving it up to the research company to determine sample sizes, survey methods, and presentation of results. So it's done jointly.
Yeah, exactly. Next one. So an online marketplace allows vendors to list and sell products. The marketplace operator collects user data for platform operation and marketing purposes. Vendors process payment information and customer data related to their sales. What is this relationship? A little bit trickier. Give you a second to think. Do you think you know it, Phil? Well, Phil's definitely listening to
Phil. What's that?
You're in the room. So we've got one for joint controllership.
I think controller to controller, I think.
In what form?
Well, the vendors are a controller in their own right when they're processing payment information related to the sales, I think. But then obviously the online marketplace allowing vendors to list and sell products is probably controller to processor.
I would have thought the online marketplace operator, if they're using the data for their own purposes, are independent. So if they're using the same pool of data, it might be that their controllers in common, or it might be they're independent.
Yeah, so I've got down independent, and in a sort of comparative way, I've thought about LinkedIn. So, you know, you've got LinkedIn that provides this platform for people to sign up to, but then also, to be fair, it's actually not particularly relevant, but Phil, don't go down this rabbit hole, please. Don't pick me up on this one. And then, you know, you've got people who might sell things or advertise things through their platform on LinkedIn that it isn't jointly determined by LinkedIn and that organization, but also, you know, they've got separate purposes. Now, there's a rabbit hole with LinkedIn, so that was a bit of a bad example, because you've got people that sign up to it directly to LinkedIn, and then who might apply for jobs on an organization's site and so on. So yeah, just go with the initial scenario for now on that one.
Having tea with the Mad Hatter.
Sean said he's already down the rabbit hole and having tea with the Mad Hatter. I think he is the Mad Hatter, to be honest.
I think you might be right. Carry
okay,
on.
And last one. Social
last
media.
Last one. No, yeah, so. We want more.
A social media platform allows users to share personal information and content. The platform uses third-party advertising companies to display targeted ads to users. The platform has limited control over the data used by these advertising companies. What is the relationship?
Between who? The social media company and the users, the social media and the advertiser?
Well, let's unpick.
I'm on the rabbit hole again.
What are your thoughts? Yeah. So on Lady's port, controller in their own respect. So I would agree with that. Jerome Phil? Is Phil Froze or
No, I'm looking at the screen. I'm trying to figure out why, you know. I mean, of course we know these things are a bit more complicated. There could be multiple different relationships for the different types of posting activities they're undertaking under the quarter broad banner, but you know, for what you've described there, I thought that they're independent controllers.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because it can be one small detail that completely changes a relationship, that or you know, there might be two
or a
parties.
Change, you know, you might set things up and then that 8 months down the track, you know, somebody says, I'm gonna try doing a different thing, and all of a sudden the relationships change. Keep track of those kind of things is really quite hard, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there might be multiple things going on with data sharing between two parties. And in some respects, there'll be controller to processor. In other respects, there'll be joint controllers or independent controllers. And it's having that awareness as well, just, you know, just to mitigate any risks.
But the point you're making, I think, Jazz, is that, and we've come across this all the time, is that you have a relationship between two organisations. And if there's multiple different purposes of that, the processing, the different types of processing that's being undertaken within that umbrella relationship, then it could be that some aspects of it is a controller processor, some aspects of it might be a controller independent controller, some aspects of it might be joint controller. And so you have to really get under the skin of it and unpack it all and understand what's going on in order to draw a determination. We found that with working with some of Vicky's clients. I think they've got very complicated arrangements, and that's what happens in life, isn't it? There's very complicated arrangements, and the law is trying to box them up and pigeonhole them and saying, well, who's determining the means and the purpose of the processing, you know?
Yeah, that's why it depends comes in so much with data protection, because it's
your middle name,
you know, it's so complicated. I know, I think most people agree. I saw something on LinkedIn the other day, I think. Was it from Barry Moss about that being a famous quote in data protection?
Yeah.
which I can definitely agree with. James so has what? Said in the chat, we're a B2B company, and as you say, it does vary or depends. The key is making it clear in the DPA, so the agreement.
Yeah.
But then the thing is with that as well, you might need data sharing clauses and then data processing clauses as well. While there's no legally specified terms for data sharing and there is for data processing, it's, you know, it is important to differentiate.
But it becomes, again, so much more complicated when you start adding an international dimension, and you've got two parties and they're working together on something, and then one party is using a third party to do something different with a subset of the data or subset of the processing, and maybe they're using a subprocessor, and maybe there's border crossings going on, and you know, it that's the reality of the modern data processing environment, isn't it? But you're trying to unpick that and define it and then put it into a legal context, you know, with agreements, is no mean feat. You know, it's really quite complicated.
Yeah.
And my approach is follow the data, you know, where's the data going, you know, what's and who's doing what to it. But I think I had a conversation with Vicky where she said that the ICO's view is follow the contracts. But you know, we've found a way. You've got a contract with the head office and a subsidiary company actually doing the processing in a completely different place. So I don't agree with that follow the contracts. I think you have to follow the data.
Well, funnily enough, I was looking on the ICO's website this morning and they've got a checklist for deciding whether it's an international transfer or not. The point one or question one is, are we planning to make a transfer of personal data outside the UK? If no, you can make the transfer. If yes, go to question two. And it's to, in determining whether it's, you know, restricted transfer or not. And that point one, if you've got an US organization, Amazon, for example, who have data centers in the UK, but are caught by American legislation, then, you know, it's not a, it's not an international transfer per se, but it's a transfer to an international organization.
Not as defined in the GDPR, but yeah, a global organization.
It's funny you say that, Jasmine. I've been having some ROPA calls this week with a customer, and they often find that they engage with, I think they use Orchard as their HMS, which is owned by MRI. And if I'm not mistaken, they're a US company. And they say that data is stored in the UK, so therefore they don't require additional safeguards. In my opinion, I don't think that's necessarily the case. Simply because obviously if you're an American organization, you're caught by Section 702 of FISA, which allows intelligence agencies access to personal data without prior authorization. And I know the chances of that are very unlikely, especially around housing data and stuff, because they're looking for, you know, things that are going to cause a threat to the US. But in theory, that transfer could happen. And therefore, I believe that additional safeguards are required, even if the data is being stored in the in a territory that has adequacy.
Yeah, and you know, the what's it called, the data privacy framework aside, it's there's a limited amount of, you know, that you can do to prevent that or to protect data, because it's their legislation that they can access that data. But there are some measures that you can put in place to at least have some oversight over what's happening with, you know, the information you share in, if it's, especially if it's controller to processor, and the processor is a US organization. Just to, I suppose it's like the supplementary measures, isn't it, before well, after Privacy Shield and all of that jazz. But it's just having as much transparency as possible and oversight over the data that you're sharing. Vicky said here in the chat, I looked into this and the ICO says you have to put the safeguard in place at the point that data will be transferred to the US under FISA and not beforehand, just in case.
That makes sense.
Does make sense. What if FISA don't, what if you don't get told though that the data's gone? I don't fully understand, but I don't think FISA would notify. They don't have to get any prior authorization, do they? I think they can just access it. I don't know how, and I don't understand necessarily the complications of it. But what, you know, what if you aren't notified of the transfer occurring and you're not able to put those safeguards in place?
I thought they had to get a warrant, but I might be wrong.
Okay.
But somebody's got to go and get the data for them, haven't they? You know, and these might be recent amendments. Vicky said they think might have to notify you, but I mean, these might be recent amendments. But you know, somebody's got to go and somehow access the data. So one would have thought that they would make a request, and so you've got to comply with the request. I mean, Apple have been complaining about having requests, FISA requests, and actually quite a lot of companies like Slack, they publish the request number of requests they've had each quarter, don't they? So making it more transparent.
Organizations often do.
Yeah, so one would think that you'd make get a request and you say, right, we're going to fulfill that request, and then we'll give us a couple of months because we've got all this red tape to wade through.
Yeah, so your point on that as well about being the amendments, I think that possibly could have been from the you know, from the EU US data privacy framework. Some of the issues with that before it was agreed was that the FISA Act obviously compromises rights, doesn't it? So I think you might be right, Phil, that might be amendments. So what you're saying then is that if you do engage with organizations such as Salesforce or Slack or Microsoft, and data is stored in Ireland or the UK, are you not required to have safeguards in place?
That's what we're saying, yeah. And unless the data does actually cross a border, you know, just because somebody's got a right of access to it under extreme circumstances, what we're saying is you don't need to have made any safeguards to accommodate that fact until it actually arises.
Mm-hmm. I suppose then the importance is the awareness that that might arise and putting measures in place to prepare for that if that is the case.
Okay. You learn something new every day.
David's got his hand up.
Yeah, I'm slightly with Joe on this. We put in place measures, or we at least go through the process of documenting the measures. So I think it would depend on a couple of factors. In most cases, it's your US organization and whether they would accede to the request and provide it. So you could be a UK entity of a US organization. The US is fully under that rights. So what we document is that we will, where lawfully able, challenge any requests. We're not lawfully able to challenge the requests, we won't. Well, we can't, basically, you know. So there's, we do a number of, as you would say, you know, in the transfer impact assessments, we document a number of things over that. I mean, the only total way around it would be if there was absolutely no way for them to get access without approaching you. So if it was encrypted in Europe and then they had to come through European lawful processes to access the data. But yeah, I think if you're on Microsoft or things like that, we generally put in place the transfer agreements and do transfer impact assessments. But, I mean, clearly it's quite an interesting area and everybody's open to make their own decisions, but that's the way that we treat it.
Yeah, I suppose you're taking a risk-based approach and saying, well, if we're a UK subsidiary of a US company, then what's the likelihood of this arising? Is it greater than if you're using a process in a process relationship? So, you know, your example about Orchard and Salesforce and that, you know, they're a processor, you're a, you know, customer and a user. I think that's different from if you're a UK subsidiary of a US company. You might say, well, there's a more formal arrangement between the two, is a, you know, legal relationship between the two, which is ownership based rather than contractual based, and therefore there might be more chance, arguably, of those kind of requests arising. And again, might depend on the type of business you're in, you know, is there much chance of this arising, what we're actually doing. So I think that you probably would take a risk-based approach and say, you know, maybe even for these relationships we're going to take some preparatory steps, at least define a process, and for these relationships we're not going to. Or maybe we have a process and we do some preparatory work for these types of relationships and we don't for those, but we have a process in place. Silence.
I wanted to touch again on, you mentioned it earlier, Phil, about the European, well, Paul Tang from the European Parliament's concerns about the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill. You know, obviously it relates to international transfers while we're on the topic, and his concerns around that. So he raised three in particular, one of them being about UK adequacy and you know, the effect on that. So he's basically put forward three questions for the Commission. The first one being, has the Commission considered the consequences that these provisions may have on law enforcement cooperation between the EU and the UK, for instance, with the PRUM 1 and PRUM 2 framework, or against the UK adequacy decision adopted under the Law Enforcement Directive? So, you know, in a similar fashion, we might be under fire like the US.
Yeah, but we might end up with, like, picking up on that point specifically, we might end up with partial adequacy. So they might say, actually, you know, we don't like the LED now, you know, and the way that's been implemented, but the GDPR is okay. We don't know. They might say, well, this sector's okay and those sectors aren't okay. Public authorities are okay or aren't okay. So you know, it might not be a kind of a either in or out. It could be that we end up with some sort of partial adequacy.
It's a shame, I mean, with that, though, that it's not that's the only issue. You know, there's concerns about biometric data of European citizens as well. Seeing as though we'll be, I suppose, getting rid of the surveillance and biometric commissioner, I forgot what it's called now. So he's raised concerns about that as well. And then he's asked the question to the Commission, if the Commission intends to annul the adequacy decision granting obviously free data flow between the EU and UK once the bill is adopted.
But I mean,
I'll be really intrigued to see how they respond to this.
Yeah, well, if you look at the three measures that are taken into consideration, or three types of stuff taken into consideration for adequacy. So, you know, this is all in Article 45 or 6, I can't remember where, 5 maybe. So the first of all, you know, that we are looking at for UK regulations, and they're looking at for internet, you know, for their adequacy. The rule of law, the respect for human rights, well, that's at risk. Mm. The fundamental freedoms, relevant legislation, both sectoral and general, public security, defence, national security, criminal law, access of data by public authorities, which is interesting because all nations obviously have got a right to access personal data. When you're in the EU club, though, it's kind of fine. And then we'll change it outside the EU club. It's kind of, oh, why have you got these rights over people? Which is interesting. And then, you know, what's the data protection legislation like? The rules, the professionals, the rules and security measures. So there's a whole load of stuff around that. And then there's a whole load of stuff around the existence and effective function of one or more independent supervisory authorities with responsibility. So, you know, if the ICO is getting watered down and becoming a politicized animal, then you'd say, well, that's a problem as well. And then the third thing is the international commitments, you know, that you've got to legally binding conventions like the Human Rights Convention. That's all at risk as well. So it's not just one problem. It's like there's a problem in each of those three categories that's used to determine adequacy or not.
Yeah, I think this will, to be honest, I think these concerns will probably have a positive effect from our perspective. In the fact that it'll hopefully usher the or urge the our parliament or our government to reconsider the bill, and it might just set it back even more.
I like Steph's comment.
Hello. For those listening to Sport, I see some I'm partially adequate t-shirts coming out. But yeah, I feel like every week there's something else about the data protection bill apart from it actually, you know, taking progressive steps. They're just dangling the carrot in front of us, really.
When we talk about mastering third party relationships, you know, I was kind of thinking about that earlier on. I was thinking, well, okay, so I'm classifying these types of relationships. I'm sure we talked about I can't remember the last session we did that. Sure we talked about processes in the past. And maybe we talked about, you know, we have talked about now joint controllers, controllers in common, independent controllers, that kind of thing. I don't know if we've talked about relationships, you know, with other third parties, like ad hoc requests for data, you know, because that all needs managing, or the relationship with the supervisory authority, or relationships with advisors such as ourselves. You know, so I think, are we aiming to go beyond just kind of the transactional stuff? And we're looking at, bearing in mind ad hoc requests will probably be transactional, but are we thinking about or wanting to think about how we're managing relationships with other third parties like the ICO and advisory bodies or not?
I mean, yeah, we probably should, to be fair. It's a really good point.
Is that part three on the way?
I don't know, but I mean, there's certain things, I've never actually... don't think I've come across anyone that's done the prior consultation Article 36 stuff with the ICO, but you know, we've all had relationships regarding breaches, and you know, we have to register, and there's a whole range of things that we do with them. We ask them for advice, you know, but just I get interested whether there's anything to talk about around our relationship with the ICO, and if we've got overseas operations with any other supervisory authority.
I mean, it comes under that ad hoc umbrella, doesn't it, really?
Well, the ad hoc request for me was, you know, when somebody rings you up or emails you and says, you know, we want some information about one of your employees, or you've got cameras on the building, you know, there's a road traffic accident, we want a copy of the footage, please. That type of ad hoc requests, rather than, you know, that's what I meant by that, to be honest.
No, but I think regardless, it would still fall under that. David said here the ICO are quite clear on discussions not to share personal data, but I don't think that prevents it entirely still. So I suppose if you're following the letter of not the law but the ICO's guidance, then you wouldn't have to consider that if you're not sharing data. But
no, I didn't mean, I meant just the relationship in a broader sense, you know, with the ICO. Not
explain.
You know, well, you know, they're the regulator. You know, they do consultations, they do issue guidance, they have the help desk line. We have invited them to speak at our events before. You know, that is, again, you probably didn't mean this in this managing third party relationships, but you know, have we got a strategy for engaging with the ICO or you know, and for some organizations it might be more important than others, just putting it out there, you know.
I don't really go to the ICO for much help, to be honest. I read a bit of the guidance and stuff. I speak to the chatbot a little bit. I don't think I trust that either. Well, it's not necessarily a chatbot, is it? Push through to somebody. But I've had some mixed bag responses from them as well. So
yeah, Sean said that in the chat. She's put, just be aware the ICO have got new people working for them and the advice can be sketchy at times while they settle in. They recently advised me that I don't need a legal basis to process personal data in general. Yeah, I think we've had it before where we've put the same question to the ICO on, you know, two separate occasions and got different responses. Phil, I think you were involved in that. Maybe you and Vicky, or was it about LinkedIn?
We've had a few bits, but we've had in the dim and distant past, you know, we rang them up about breaches and they were telling us, you know, these things aren't. We spoke to a client this week, didn't we, Joe, about a situation.
Yeah.
And you know, they were saying, no, that's not a breach because there was no breach of security, you know, where we thought, well, there was. We go, all right, fine, that's fine. Just email us that response and we'll be fine. We'll go away and leave you alone. We said, give us your name and log the name, the phone, and get a transcript of the conversation. Stick it on the breach file. Why didn't you report this? And because you told us not to.
Yeah, you definitely have to be careful. It's like maybe they're using ChatGPT. You never know. So I was having a thing prior to the session as well. So last time we touched on due diligence and, you know, data processing agreements, data sharing agreements and things like that. But it got me thinking, you know, once you've got the paperwork there, you've done your checks on paper, you file it away, what does that actually mean in practice, and how is that effective in practice? How do you, you know, bring a you know, your due diligence checks or your data processing agreement terms to life? What is required to make sure that people's data is protected in sharing their data?
How do you bring them to life?
What
do you mean?
So
you've done your due diligence, so, yeah.
Yeah, and you enter into an agreement and you've got that agreement there for, you know, in the scenario when you need to rely on it to say, look, you said in contract that you will implement appropriate measures and you know, technical and organizational measures, and you'll assist with DPAs or whatever it is. But once you've signed that contract, what are the next steps to ensure that personal data is protected, aside from the fact that you've got an insurance policy as a controller, let's say in this instance, on your processor if something goes wrong? Yeah. How do you prevent?
Let me just, this is a complete aside, right? But in the, I always get picked up by people who read our standard operating procedure on processes on the template, because there's a section there and it says managing data processes, and it says this section is intentionally blank. And everyone says, well, why don't you get rid of it? And I say to them, well, it's there because if you need to put processes in place to manage processes, you know, things that you want to do, you know, whether it's training or monitoring or whatever, it goes in that section there. But we haven't got any recommendations in that area, so it's not, we haven't put that into our pre-populated template of our SOP. But that's what you're talking about, isn't it, really? How are you operationalizing that relationship? You know, how you ensuring that data is deleted in accordance with the retention period, you know, that the process was stipulated. Are you going out and doing audits? Do you expect them to submit an annual return, you know, some kind of statement of what they've done or what they're doing or where they are, or that they've had audits? Is that what you mean? That kind of
Yeah, exactly that.
Well, I'd do that kind of stuff.
That's a good idea. No, exactly that. You know, putting it into a procedure or a policy is a really good way to do that, because a lot of the time, you know, due diligence prior to entering into a relationship is considered just to be confident that they are aware of data protection, they've got sufficient measures in place. But then what about for the actual sharing of data with that between parties? You know, their data protection measures might relate to employment data, because they're a processor in the main, for especially for the services in which you're acquiring them for. So it's not just the tick box exercise, really, and sometimes it can be seen like that and it's a bit of a risk. So having those steps in place, even just for the transfer of data, you know, encryption and security measures around that, for example, all the way to deleting the data, and in between as well. It's an ongoing thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And too often it is a box ticking exercise, but you've got to have the ability to say, actually, this is, and I'm not seeing it very often at all. You know, this is a high risk process. We aren't using them, or this is a high risk transfer of data. We're not doing it. Mm. I've seen it on a few occasions, but it's on rare occasions.
Yeah. And, you know, is there any chance of, through putting those measures in place, of avoiding, I don't know, breaches?
Well, you never know. That's the problem, isn't it? You don't know, do you? And until you have a breach, you know, it's either because you've got a fantastic process in place and you know, or you just haven't been targeted as effectively as other people have. You just don't know until it's too late.
I had a call with one of my customers this week about a breach that, well, considering whether it was a breach and whose responsibility it was, that I thought, you know what, this will be a good thing to talk about on the podcast. Let me hand it over to Joe.
I don't think we're gonna have time to unpick it.
Really?
Well, should we save it for the GDPR radio next week? It's quite a complicated
I think it should whet the appetite.
Oh, what? A little promo?
Yeah, giving the answer. Yeah.
Okay. Something to mull over for the next week. Yeah. Please bear with me and hopefully I get this right. But a customer of ours sent out a newsletter via Postcampaign to their supporters. And they got a bit of backlash the other day from a newsletter that was sent out 2 years ago, because the newsletter went to a previous address. And at that previous address, there was somebody that the data subject didn't want them to know who they were. I think it was, is that right, Phil?
So the organization sent out a number of mail shots periodically, and they had three returned to sender. And so they decided that what they would do is they'd cleanse their data, you know, not at this address. So they cleansed their data and they updated their database with a new address, which they'd sourced via effectively ultimately from the Royal Mail forwarding address file via Cygnus, who was a very respectable data broker in that space. And then they sent out another newsletter. And then they got a complaint recently saying that newsletter you sent me went to somebody, went to an address which I didn't give you, and it went to somebody who I don't want to know where I live, and that's caused me a lot of stress. I'm signed off work with sick, you know, stress and all sorts of hassle. So you know, this client is looking at you know, well, how did this arise? You know, where is the fault? You know, should we have updated our records sooner? Et cetera, et cetera. What it's transpired is that they updated their database with an address that the person used to live at before the address that they had on file. So imagine you got address number one, address number two, and now living in address number three. You know, we were mailing about address number two. We then said we need to cleanse our data and update it with address number one. And then we sent a mail shot to address number one. And it wasn't so much they didn't want to know where they lived. It was that they've changed their name and their surname. And so the person who lives at address number one now knows they've changed their surname and might find it easy to track them down. So they're saying, no, the fault isn't with us. You know, the fault is with the Royal Mail. You know, their file was not up to date. And it could actually be the fault lies with the data subject. It depends, you know, in the process, how the updating of addresses works. But that was quite interesting because they've fulfilled their obligation under the accuracy principle effectively and updated their data with older data, inaccurate data.
Could you not argue though that it's, you know, the controller's responsibility to do carry out checks? You know, if you're going to get this address from Royal Mail, should you maybe perhaps contact the data subject and just say, you know, we've had a few bounce backs, we've been given this new address by the Royal Mail, can you confirm that this is the new address before we send it out? Could you argue that?
You could do, but I mean, I was thinking, you know, on the face of it, I was thinking, well, you know, you wouldn't think sending a newsletter out would be so harmful.
No,
you know, so you might not have classified that as sufficiently impactful to justify that kind of thing. And if you're talking about like a it's a charity, like millions of supporters, you know, is it practicable to go and do that every time this kind of thing arises? And actually, yeah. do you expect the Royal Mail? And we don't, one thing we don't know is a time frame. This could have all happened yeah. within 3 weeks, you know, the address 1, 2, and 3. So it could be that the file was in the process of being updated. All these are all questions we pose back to the client. But what was your conundrum, Joe? What was the kind of the thing you wanted mulling over? Whose fault it was?
Yeah, whose fault it was, and was it a personal data breach?
And now that was the interesting thing, wasn't it? Because we were saying, well, where's the breach of security?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, there's damage, there's harm, there's stress, but where's the breach of security?
Yeah, so we'll leave you on that one, shall we?
To be continued. Oh,
to be
Michael
continued, Michael, next Friday.
Oh, maybe I'll have something else.
No, I think it's like with everything, it's you're going to try and find out what kind of harm it caused the person, right? And take it from there. Sorry, I just had a mind blank, so I'm sorry, I probably answered it wrong. It's a Friday, isn't it? You just yeah, anyway, so yeah, that's something that you always have to weigh up with these sort of things, right? To see if even if it doesn't fit most of our parameters for things, if he's saying that it's caused him a lot of emotional and mental and physical issues, right, it brings up the scale. And then you would probably say, okay, based on, even if they did it themselves, they actually caused the breach themselves, you could probably still say, well, you're still going to tell the ICO, but actually we were struggling a little bit with the principles here. Can you help us out? Because, you know, you don't get very easy cases. I mean, I had one where someone mentioned a person was in the hospital and it led to a death. So, you know, that was completely, what do you tell people? They can't have proper conversations or limit what they say over the phone. That's good, but it really raises the risk and the damage to such a high level, and you just do what you can, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, on that note, we'll call it there. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the session. We'll be back next week for GDPR Radio, where we'll pick up the conversation again. So thank you for joining. And yeah, good to have you back, Phil. Thanks, Joe, for your contributions.
Thanks New for rabbit hosting, hole
Jasmine. Will soon come. See you later, everyone.
Have a good weekend.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.